Chapter 3 Mirror, mirror, how do you look to your customers? My lovely wife Joan was born and bred a Glaswegian, and as with many of her fellow Scots, she loves to quote the great Scottish poet Robert Burns. By osmosis, therefore, I too have become familiar with some of the works of the bard. Rabbi Burns is possibly best known as the author of Auld Lang Syne, which most of us sing every New Year in various states of inebriation. Of all the words he wrote, however, the ones that have always resonated with me come from his somewhat unlikely titled poem, To a Louse, in which he wrote, "Oh, would some power the gifty gie us to see ourselves as others see us." Simply stated, this does of course mean, if only we had the power to see ourselves in the same way that others see us. Of all the mantras one might adopt in life, this is surely one of the better ones, and for anyone in a leadership role, it should be an essential part of the checks and balances that are built into a company's standard operating procedures. I suppose the corporate version of Burns's famous line would read something like, "Always try to look at what we are doing from the customer's perspective." If it walks like a duck. Like it or not, in the eyes of our customers, employees, friends, whoever, perception is very much reality. Or as the old saying goes, if it walks like a duck, it usually is a duck. The ability to see one's own actions, either personally or corporately, through the eyes of others, is a skill that takes practice, and ideally, one that should be applied well in advance of making public statements or policy decisions that might be open to ambiguity or question. We are all consumers, and yet I am constantly amazed at how many business people seem to dwell in some kind of subjective blinkered cocoon instead of looking objectively at their own products and services. Even more amazing is the simple fact that we are all surrounded by highly objective, ready-made focus groups. You don't have to go outside and pay them to sit in a mirrored room. They're around us every day and go by the name of family, friends, employees, and acquaintances. In my experience, some of the harshest and most valuable sounding boards you will ever find can be found around the family dinner table. I cannot begin to tell you how many times what I thought to be a really good idea never made it past the tough audience of Joan and the kids. I will never forget her no-holds-barred response to one new idea in particular that I casually announced over dinner with her one night. Never! It was during the height of the HIV/AIDS epidemic in the late 80s, and I was thrilled to see how fired up everyone at Virgin was about doing something positive to help tackle this dreadful disease that was destroying the lives of millions. In typical fashion, we brainstormed to try and come up with some practical contribution we could make, and before long, someone had the great idea of setting up a company that would manufacture and sell condoms for a fraction of the price being demanded by Durex, the UK's dominant condom manufacturer. Nobody stopped to consider any potential disconnects on the branding front, and we simply set about turning the idea into a reality. Flash forward to my excited dinner table announcement that we were planning to introduce a new product line that would go by the name of Virgin Condoms. I remember seeing Joan choke on her food before exclaiming in her wonderful Glasgow accent, "Condoms! Virgin condoms! Oh, come on, Richard, please tell me you're joking. 'Cause if you're not, you're soon going to be the butt end of a hell of a lot of jokes." And of course, she was absolutely correct. As is often the case, with the best will in the world, one can simply get too wrapped up in the creative process and forget to step back and see how whatever you're working on is going to look from the customer's perspective. In this instance, we were all so fired up with the big idea that nobody had given a moment's thought to how nonsensical it would be to offer a product called Virgin Condoms. I mean, it would be almost as crazy as starting a company by the name of Virgin Bride. Oops, well, maybe even crazier. In any case, following Joan's astute observation, we went straight back to the drawing board and quickly came up with a clever solution. Our first venture into the latex wear business would instead be branded as Mates, which, if you think about it, is really quite appropriate. And the M on the front of the logo was cleverly crafted using an inverted version of our own signature Virgin V. If it ain't broke, break it. Not everyone, it seems, has access to a pragmatic market expert like my wife. Or more likely they do, but they clearly are not making very good use of them. Imagine, for instance, how differently things might have turned out for Reed Hastings, CEO of video rental company Netflix, had he polled his family's or friends' reaction to the question, "Okay, folks, how would you feel about a new Netflix offer that will give you the same service you enjoy today, but for twice the price and with double the complexity?" Now, as I've said, I'm not a betting man, but I'd have put money on the response to that one. Clearly, however, such a conversation never took place. In July of 2011, Netflix was flush with success. It had 23 million subscribers, its stock price was riding at an all-time high at around $300, and new members by the boatload were signing up every month. And then, in September, for reasons that no one can fully explain, the DVD rental giant shocked Wall Street analysts and its employees and customers alike by announcing it was revamping its highly successful business model. They announced that a new spin-off company, Quixter, would take on the mailbox DVD rental side of the business, while those customers who preferred streaming video would buy that separately from the newly pared-down Netflix. What had been working just fine for them, a single monthly fee to Netflix for both services, would now be payable to two separate entities, doubling the complexity and forcing customers to lock into choices they didn't really want to face. The attempted transition was so badly executed on every front that it quickly turned out to be an exercise in "United we stand, divided we fall." Some analysts speculated that the company may have been foolishly attempting to fast-forward evolution by trying to wean its client base away from the old-fashioned business of having DVDs delivered by mail with all the associated logistics, warehousing complexities, and costs, none of which existed with the rapidly growing online streaming mode of video delivery. Everyone agreed that video streaming was indisputably the way of the future, but such a monumentally dumb move was certainly not the way to get there. The customer reaction was instantaneous and furious. Within a month, almost a million of them cancelled their subscriptions, and the company's stock, which in July had been trading above $300, had fallen to around the $100 mark by early September. It was way too late for the publicly embarrassed Reed Hastings to have that dinner table chat with the family, but to his credit, he did at least react quickly by instantly hitting the brakes before the ill-conceived new structure ever took effect. Quixter was quickly gone, and in what was described in one report as a tear-stained apology to both the remaining and recently departed Netflix subscribers, Hastings openly admitted, "I messed up, and I owe everyone an explanation." What that explanation didn't say, however, was, "If only I'd talked this over with my friends and family, none of this fiasco might have happened." While Netflix almost managed to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory, happily the company has recovered well as a predominantly online provider, although the dinosaur-in-waiting of DVDs by mail still contributes significant revenues. A lesson to be learned from this story is the importance of leaders displaying the courage to own up to and accept responsibility for their mistakes, then act to quickly fix them and move on. Last time I checked, Netflix stock was in the region of $450, so its shareholders' pain was a temporary thing as a result of the quick actions of a CEO who wasn't afraid to admit that, like all human beings, he was fallible. How to shoot yourself in the can. While the Netflix story is one of the more recent examples of failing to look at a business from the outside in the annals of blinkered decision-making, it is by no means the most incredible. That honor must surely belong to the Coca-Cola Company. Coke is not just one of the world's biggest selling and most recognizable brands, but it has fiercely loyal customers, as we discovered when we tried to go up against them with Virgin Cola, or Virgin Coke, as I was prone to calling it until several of our lawyers suggested I might be wise to cease and desist. Unfortunately for us, Virgin Cola never succeeded in wreaking 0.1% of the damage to Coca-Cola that they managed to inflict upon themselves in the mid-80s. I am usually a believer in the "if it ain't broke, fix it anyway" school of thought, but what happened with the ill-fated introduction of New Coke was, as someone described it at the time, like trying to improve the Mona Lisa's smile by painting over it. On the 23rd of April, 1985, a date that will forever ever live in fizzy drink infamy, Coca-Cola surprised the planet by suddenly introducing their New Coke and simultaneously ceased production of the original formulation. This was no ordinary drink they were messing around with. I read somewhere once that 10,000 Cokes are consumed around the world every second of every day. With that kind of a following, it was hardly surprising that the reaction around the Coke-drinking world to the New Coke's coming was nothing short of seismic. It was a textbook case of just how flawed a strategy it can be to place too much reliance on assuming the customer knows what they want. The guys in the white lab coats at Coke had conducted extensive blind taste tests with existing customers and others, all of whom had apparently indicated a strong acceptance, if not necessarily a preference, for the planned New Coke's slightly sweeter formulation. Of course, these tests had been conducted in somewhat of a vacuum, and none of those contributing to the shocking result had been asked, "We are glad you like this. Now, how would you feel about it replacing the Coca-Cola that you've loved all your life?" The stunned consumer response was, to put it mildly, not pretty. The company HQ in Atlanta was deluged with hundreds of thousands of calls and letters expressing utter disgust from global Coke drinkers. To a person, they not only didn't like the new taste, but also felt betrayed that the decision to go ahead and change their favorite drink had been taken without any open consultation process. Many felt that, at the very least, the old and new versions should have been offered side by side on supermarket shelves for a time so that consumers could have made their own choice. As a fan of well-written complaint letters, even when addressed to me, I have to say that some of those received by Coca-Cola should be enshrined in a hall of shame somewhere. Coke's CEO, Roberto Goizueta, was inevitably singled out as the villain of the piece, and Coca-Cola's CEO and Chief Dodo were two of the more polite forms of address taken by angry letter writers. One missive even asked the embattled executive for his signature, on the grounds that the autograph of one of the dumbest executives in American business history will likely become valuable someday. Even a few offshore fans chimed in. From Cuba, lifelong Coke drinker Fidel Castro dubbed the misadventure as a sign of American decadence. Of course, he was probably thinking, how can I have a Cuba Libre without Coke? It turned out that Castro's much-publicized comment only served to get CEO Goizueta into more hot water, this time from his own father. He later recounted how his dad, a Cuban who had fled his homeland to get away from Castro, told his son in no uncertain terms that he had screwed up big time. But the classic capper to this story was when he reportedly said, "Roberto, I think this is the only time in my life that I have agreed with something Fidel Castro had to say." Now, I am not suggesting that soliciting the input of foreign dictators is necessarily the way to go, but when you have family and friends who are also consumers, it is downright foolish not to take full advantage and listen to their outside-in points of view. The customer is always relevant. Please don't think that by promoting outside-in vision, I am suggesting that the customer is always right. Far from it. In fact, in my experience, particularly with anything that represents a really game-changing innovation, I believe that most consumer opinions tend to be overly cautious and tempered by what they have or have not experienced in the past. If they cannot envisage what you are talking about because they have never experienced anything like it, then they are likely to be overly guarded in their comments. For a variety of reasons, and as the new Coke taste test fiasco demonstrates, I have always had trouble accepting the validity of the kind of consumer feedback that is garnered from formal focus groups. This is the kind where they all sit down in a room and pretend they don't know they're being watched and recorded by the people behind the mirror. Not only does it frequently bring out the prima donna in some members of the group, who see it as an opportunity to perform for the cameras, but most groups behave like sheep. Usually one dominant participant will have the most boisterous opinions, and the others will meekly get in line behind them. Now, while there is always a similar risk within a family group, at least you know a little bit more about the people involved, and they also aren't walking away at the end of dinner knowing their comments will never come back to haunt them. For example, if I had chosen to ignore my wife Joan's virgin condom comments and gone ahead with the name anyway, I suspect I might have chosen to eat out for a while. The approach we have taken in deciding what our new Virgin hotels should look like is a good example of the Virgin way of taking advantage of family input. Certainly, the women in my life, my wife Joan and daughter Holly, have had their say, but in this case, the family I am talking about is the extended Virgin family of companies, their employees, and our 50 million or so customers around the world. The Virgin Hotels input in question was not by way of any formal research, but by leveraging our years of acquired understanding as to what our customers like and expect from Virgin-branded products and services. It is vital that our new hotels exude all the same elements of unrivaled personal service and design excellence tempered with user-friendly functionality that have evolved by trial and error with our three airlines at Limited Edition, our Resort Luxury Escapes division, at Virgin Active, and other family member ventures. As Ali Hope, the head of development at Virgin Hotels, likes to put it, it's all about stylish functionality, about leveraging what works and transforming what doesn't. An example of something we know works extremely well for our Virgin Atlantic upper-class customers is our clubhouse lounges. As anyone who has ever visited our flagship London Heathrow clubhouse will tell you, It is just an amazing oasis of pre-flight calm in which to relax, enjoy a meal, play pool, have a massage, a haircut, a shoe shine, or, if you must, work. Everything we have learned over the years with the steady refinement of our clubhouses will be incorporated into Virgin Hotels, which will all have a 24/7 clubhouse-like space for guests to make their own. It will also make for a very seamless hospitality experience for our airline loyalists, who we fully anticipate will be the first ones in line for our new hotel offering. After all, they already sleep with us in the air, so why not do it on the ground as well? And when it comes to transforming what doesn't work in the hotel space, as with every one of our businesses, we have found there to be no lack of amazing opportunities for us to ring the changes. One big little facet we have focused on is the needs and expectations of our women guests, where lots of little details that are easily overlooked can make the difference between an okay stay and a, wow, I can't believe they thought of that, experience. And again, we have an abundance of female executives within Virgin, many of whom travel incessantly, so we have gleaned a wealth of input from this travel-savvy sorority within the family. Raoul Leal, the highly experienced hotel professional that we brought in to head up Virgin Hotels, won me over the instant he told me that his vision for our hotels was one of exclusivity for all. While the big legacy hotel chains might be classified as reliably boring, and some of the more established lifestyle hotel brands take a slightly holier-than-thou red rope view on the world, our hotels will bridge the gap between the two. We'll be neither ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen, nor too cool for school. Instead, we'll be fun, slightly cheeky and irreverent, and everyone, whether a guest or an associate, should feel better for the experience. We have done an equal amount of work in ensuring both groups feel treasured, and we know that creating raving fans in our guests will only happen if we can achieve the same level of engagement from our own people. What's happening at Virgin Hotels is just an extension of the tried and true belief in trusting your own consumer-based instincts. This is, of course, considered a very pragmatic investment strategy. If, as a consumer, you really like using a particular product and purchase it over other choices every time, then presumably lots of others do the same, so it may be a stock worth acquiring. The ultimate example of such consumer behavior is the tale of American entrepreneur Victor Kiam, who made a fortune from his company Remington Products. As the story goes, his wife bought him a Remington electric razor, and as he famously said in their advertising campaigns, "I like the product so much, I bought the company." Check yourself out. So the simple fact is that any business leader worthy of their paycheck should, at every possible opportunity, be playing the role of a consumer of their own company's goods and services. It has never been the Virgin way to put too much credence in the findings of third-party customer satisfaction ratings, when so much more can be gleaned from testing your own product firsthand at every possible opportunity. Despite living in an online age, when things go amiss, consumers should be able to talk to someone, a real someone, not an electronic avatar. So when you're playing customer, one of the first things to do is to try and locate a phone number to call on your website that will enable you to get through to a real human being. If you can find the number, most organizations foolishly bury a contact number in some deep, dark corner of the website after Contact Us has led you nowhere except back to the web page you started on. Try calling it and count how many recorded options, pre-screens, and handoffs you are forced through before you, perhaps, get to a real person. Once you get to that human voice, have a reasonable problem ready, one that they should be able to fix, and see how well they do and how pleasantly they go about it. If they do it really well, you might want to consider identifying yourself at the end of the call and praising their efforts. If they get it hopelessly wrong, you are better off taking the story to their supervisor so the failing can become a training subject. Or, for some real fun, play-act the part of a dissatisfied customer and try and call yourself just to see what happens. Do you get an incredulous, "No, I can't possibly put you through to Mr. Smith's office"? Or, if you are put through, don't worry, you aren't there to take your own call, how much grief are you subjected to in order to get there? Are you, the irate customer, deflected to someone who can genuinely take an interest and help you with your problem, or are you just headed off at the pass? I tried pulling this stunt myself once, but it didn't work out too well. I am so pathetically bad at imitating someone else's voice that Penny, my trusty assistant for many years, sat there and let me make a complete fool of myself with some trumped-up complaint before saying, "Well, thank you so much for sharing all that with me, sir. Let me see if Mr. Branson is available to take your call." She then kept me hanging on for what seemed like an eternity, it was probably a couple of minutes, before coming back on the line to say, "Sorry, Richard, but you appear to be out of the office at the moment. Can someone else help you?" before dissolving into howls of laughter. But give it a shot. I'm sure you'll be able to make a much better job of it than I did. I had greater success on the phone when I was based full-time in the UK and used to frequently cold-call Virgin Atlantic passengers who had just arrived at Heathrow. Our upper-class, business-class passengers could easily be tracked down on their way into London as they were in the limos we had supplied for them. The drivers were primed to expect this, and to simply pass the phone back saying, "It's a call for you, sir, madam." Needless to say, they were surprised at getting a call and so would usually start out with a very suspicious, "Hello, who's this?" to which I'd typically answer with a cheery, "Hello, this is Richard Branson. I'm just calling to welcome you to England and ask if everything went well on the flight." Needless to say, I got a lot of, "Yeah, sure it is. Who is this really?" type reactions, some in much less printable language. But when we did finally strike up a conversation, it was always time incredibly well spent on my part. Complaints, or observations, as I prefer to call them, are usually unsolicited, and with too many companies, not particularly welcome. So a senior person reaching out and inviting honest input really wins a lot of points, as well as bringing in some interesting insights. In the case of my calls to the limos, the results were almost always a win-win-win. The passenger was impressed that I'd made the effort to contact them. I got a lot of excellent, hot-off-the-press feedback that I could immediately address with the airline, and I was also able to pass along any specific compliments to the cabin crew or airport staff, who were never that surprised to take my calls. It was also a great way to say thank you to our most frequent flyers. I liked to be tipped off when a passenger was going through milestones, like, say, 100,000 miles, and would call to congratulate them and say how much we appreciate their loyalty. A little thank you goes a long way. I have always found it to be one of the more intriguing idiosyncrasies of the human condition that a problem that is handled quickly and effectively will almost always serve to generate more long-term customer loyalty than when the original service was delivered satisfactorily. That said, I am a huge believer in the old customer service mantra of first to know, first to handle. If someone can fix a problem on the spot, it saves all kinds of angst for the customer, plus time and expense for the company. Just as importantly, an on-the-spot resolution more often than not will also keep a customer in the fold. Call it leadership in reverse, if you like, but any company that views their business's level of performance strictly through the optic of the bottom line is living very dangerously. That kind of blinkered view from the boardroom thinking was what cost Steve Jobs his job at Apple, and history very quickly showed where that took the company, almost to the point of extinction. So, rather than sitting in a gilded cage, believing what the financials and customer surveys seem to indicate, effective leaders have got to set an example and get out there kicking the tires on a regular basis. I am probably one of the biggest constructive critics of every Virgin company, always balanced with praise where appropriate, of course. Whenever I experience our services, as good and trendsetting as they might be, there is nearly always a way to improve upon them. Yes, I can sometimes be accused of nitpicking when I travel with my notebook in hand, but it's invariably the small details that combine to make memorably good or bad customer experiences. Like, why were we handing out hot towels to our newly boarded passengers on a boiling hot Las Vegas day? Wouldn't cold towels make a lot more sense? I have always found that having senior people who demonstrably care enough to pay attention to customer-focused nitty-gritty details, as opposed to just the stock price, serves to encourage everyone in the organization to get into the habit of seeing what you look like from the outside in. A domino benefit is that middle managers don't want a senior officer to be the first to tell them how their part of the operation looks from the other side of the fence, especially if they've never troubled to set foot over there themselves. As an example of continually attempting to see yourself as others see you, now that Virgin Hotels is opening its doors, I will be encouraging our hotel managers to regularly spend unannounced nights sleeping in random empty rooms in their properties. Just spending a few minutes inspecting a room during the day doesn't give any clue as to what paying guests experience while sleeping there for the night. If you want to fully grasp what you are selling, then you have got to see it from the customer's perspective. Or in this case, when you've made the bed, then you've got to sleep in it too. While on the subject of hospitality, perhaps the boldest management initiatives I've ever witnessed was in a Florida property used by Virgin Holidays. The manager there had put his picture, name and phone numbers, office, cell phone and home, inside every elevator. The note with it read something along the lines of, "If there is any problem during your stay that is not resolved to your satisfaction by our staff, please feel free to give me a call." When I asked him if this hadn't been a problem, his response was, "For me, not at all. For my staff, maybe. I made sure they know how much I dislike getting disturbed when I'm at home with the family." He then added that in the year the signs had been in place, he'd maybe received a couple of calls a month. A great example of the senior person putting themselves on the front line 24/7. When I was hands-on CEO at Virgin Atlantic, I did something similar with our staff. I'd write them a letter every month with an update on how things were going, and before cell phones and email, gave them my home address and home phone number if they wanted to get in touch with me. And, as with the Florida hotel manager, on the rare occasions they did, I was always delighted to hear what they had to say. See yourself as the competition sees you. Running a business would be a lot easier if finding a leader were as simple as handing out impressive titles like CEO, President, Managing Director, or whatever. A fancy corporate title with a C in front of it might open doors, once at least, or get more people to take a phone call, but it doesn't guarantee the levels of respect and influence that are the marks of a real leader. Those who earned the position, as opposed to merely having it bestowed upon them. To this day, too many businesses still view the top job as being the prerogative of the next in line, who has diligently put in their years as the number two person in the corporate pecking order. That might work in royal families, but it certainly doesn't always get it done in a lot of business situations. Middle management can make or break a company, so having good departmental leaders at all levels is vital to any business, but not every good manager is going to naturally grow into a senior leadership role. It certainly happens in a number of cases, but it's no given. Too often, when the number two person is moved up, it is done to ensure continuity in the way the firm is run, which usually translates to business as usual, or protecting the prior incumbent's legacy. This may make sense with some highly successful companies, but even there, I've always found a transition at the top is a perfect opportunity to get a fresh perspective on where the company is going or not, and if necessary, then a little shake, rattle and roll never did anyone any harm. Clearly, when considering candidates for leadership positions, their resumes, CVs, have to come into play, but they really should be judged equally on their vision for the future as on what they've achieved in the past. If a company is to move forward, hiring clones of the previous incumbent will rarely generate much in the way of positive change. No matter how good the previous person in the job might have been, there is always room for improvement. So my favorite question with internal applicants has always been, so if you get the job, what are the first things you are going to change around here, and why? Much as we like to hire from inside at Virgin, I have no aversion to bringing in new blood from the outside. A pair of fresh eyes and ears can often see latent opportunities that long-term employees have simply come to accept as the norm. The inside on the outside. As it happens, over the last few years, we have put new CEOs in charge of our two biggest airlines, Virgin Atlantic and Virgin Australia, and in both cases, I believe we may have surprised a few people by replacing the long-term incumbents with senior executives from two major legacy airlines. In Australia, we most certainly shook the industry a little by hiring John Borghetti to take over from the airline's outgoing founder, Brett Godfrey. As a 36-year veteran of Qantas, Australia's dominant carrier, John had quite literally started in the mailroom and worked his way up to the second highest position in the company. When he came to us, he was more than a little bit bummed because he had just been passed over for the top job there. In my opinion, this was a huge mistake on Qantas's part, but we remain eternally grateful to them for letting someone like John escape their clutches. So much so, in fact, that after we'd had John on board for a couple of months, I was sorely tempted to send Qantas's chairman a thank you for the wonderful gift note, but managed to resist the urge. My first meeting with John to discuss the possibilities of joining us was in Singapore after the F1 Grand Prix, and I have to confess I was incredibly impressed. I'd been extremely doubtful that a career, 36 years is a long time in any one place, big airline guy, could ever be a good fit at our somewhat funky little Australian operation, but he proved that I was way off the mark. John came totally prepared with strategies for everything he thought needed to be done to take Virgin to new heights, and was clearly our man. While all the dating books say you should never get into a relationship with anyone who's on the rebound from a failed marriage, I felt there was a lot more than a revenge motive in John. Yes, he was angry, and justifiably so, that he hadn't been offered the top job at Qantas after spending his entire career there, but it was as if he was desperately seeking an outlet for all the things he hadn't been able to get done while at his former employer. When I asked him why he had not put a particularly smart initiative he'd suggested in place while he was at Qantas, he simply replied, "Because I wasn't the CEO and didn't have the board's support. Here, I already get the feeling that's not going to be a problem." Suffice it to say that if we had a cloning machine and the ability to replicate our best and brightest virgin leaders, John would be one of the first ones we pushed in there. He is a highly strategic thinker, and yet he also has outstanding people skills, which is a must-have for any CEO in a virgin company. One big bonus, of course, is that he certainly knows how to read the mind of our biggest competitor in Australia. On a couple of occasions, I have been convinced that he knew what they were going to do next before they did. I suppose 36 years in one place will do that for you. But equally importantly, he had been carefully observing everything that had been going on at Virgin Blue, later Virgin Australia, and had a competitor's perspective on how we were not quite as smart as we thought we were in a few areas. In other words, he brought that all-important ability to see ourselves as others see us, and to act accordingly upon a few minor course corrections. It has also brought with it a new energy that the staff has named the NBO, the New Borghetti Order. John makes it part of his routine to do what the Australians call going walkabout around the company. When he does this, one of the many things that make the NBO different is John's habit of not just saying, "Hi, how are you?" but instead taking the time to get into deep, impromptu discussions with all level of employees and, importantly, acting on their feedback rather than telling them he'll consider it and moving on. One interesting observation John made right up front was that he felt we had maybe been too intent on driving the brand as opposed to the business. Having observed what we were doing for years through the eyes of a competitor, he told me, and I wrote it down in my notebook, that he felt the brand image we had developed was misrepresenting some of the airline's richest qualities. By this, he meant that the kind of party central, super laid back image that Virgin Blue had developed in Australia had led to a lot of potential customers, particularly older, more straight-laced business flyers, failing to see us as a serious enough player to be deserving of their business. Funnily enough, this was exactly the same identity crisis we'd once had to confront at Virgin Atlantic many years earlier, when we were initially perceived as the rock and roll airline. Conversely, John also, quite bravely, I thought, expressed his thinking that our aircraft liveries, fuselage paint jobs, needed a little bit of tweaking for the Aussie market. He felt that Virgin Atlantic and Virgin America's applications of the Virgin logo were overly conservative and that they needed something a little more contemporary. I say bravely because for many years in Virgin, the logo was sacrosanct and something that should not be tampered with under any circumstances. Anyway, when John raised the subject in front of all the airline heads, I was probably expected to be the one to quickly put this Qantas interloper in his place and say something like, "Sorry, but that is one area where we cannot go." On the contrary, other than John, I think I was the only one in the room who thought it made sense, and so said, "Screw it, if that's what you think you need, then let's do it." The result was a very different-looking sideways rendition of the logo that, in all honesty, some love and some don't, but the updated treatment freshened up the brand and got us lots of media and consumer attention in the process. But just to show that nothing is truly sacred, another more outlandish modification of the Virgin Atlantic brand was to be seen in Los Angeles when the airline sponsored a big joint promotion with the 1999 Austin Powers movie, the spy who shagged me. Billboards all over L.A. featured Virgin Shaglantic and a variety of somewhat bawdy one-liners from the Mike Myers character. When, after the fact, the Logo Police, as the group's custodians of the brand are affectionately known in London, found out about this mangling of one of our biggest brand names, they were suitably appalled. When they tackled the US marketing team as to whether they had asked for approval, the response was a no-nonsense, "No, of course not. We decided this was one of those occasions when it was better to ask for forgiveness than permission." When I found out about it, all I could do was smile and do a lame, "Ooh, baby," impression of Austin Powers. Back in Australia, though, there are still a couple of things on which John Borghetti and I have not completely come to terms, as yet. First of all, he expressed a concern that we spent too much time and money on staff parties. That's one that I think we will win him over on after he's been to a few more of them. The other one is his proclivity for tie-wearing, something born out of all those years at stuffy old Qantas, I'm sure. This is another part of the virginization process that I am confident will also get sorted out in time. So far, I think I have only snipped off a couple of his expensive silk ties with my ever-ready scissors. With other chronic tie-wearing cases such as John, I found it can sometimes take as many as 3 or 4 tie-ectomies before they are completely cured of the habit. Our second imported airline CEO is Craig Krieger at Virgin Atlantic, who, like John in Australia, joined us after a very long time at a legacy airline. In Craig's case, he put in 27 years at American Airlines, but despite this, it appears he won't be too difficult to untie. I met Craig for the first time when he came to Necker Island as the last stop on the selection process bandwagon. When I asked him what his greatest concern was about coming to work for Virgin, he surprised me by saying, "Well, to be perfectly honest, Richard, probably knowing what to pack to come down here to meet you. I figured that I wouldn't need a tie, but after that I hadn't got a clue as to what the dress code was going to be." I think Craig must have been the first person ever to have worried about dress code when meeting me, and I am sure it will never again be a problem for him. As with John in Australia 3 years earlier, Craig's hiring may have been a surprise to a few people who had thought Steve Ridgway's successor — Steve had been Virgin Atlantic's CEO for 12 years — was probably going to come from within the airline. Again, though, like in Australia, we opted to take someone from a big legacy carrier. It wasn't the first time we went fishing at American, having hired David Cush from there to head up Virgin America some years earlier. From the get-go, I was impressed with Craig's easygoing manner, and one part of his CV also jumped off the page. His role at American several years earlier in London had included putting together American Airlines' big alliance with British Airways. As we were just about to announce that Delta Airlines had acquired the 49% stake in Virgin Atlantic that Singapore Airlines had held for a number of years, we needed someone to mastermind that new relationship on our behalf. Singapore had always been a very passive partner, but the Delta relationship was going to be very different, and maximizing on every ounce of the many transatlantic synergies the new relationship would present was going to be critical to the ongoing growth and profitability of the airline we had built from scratch in 1984. So Craig was our man, and while at the time of writing he is still relatively new to the job, he is already making his mark and has established a highly comprehensive 2-year plan against which everyone can measure their own and the company's progress. Both John and Craig are demonstrating my long-held belief that everything can always be improved upon, and often only someone who has seen your operation from the outside in can bring the required perspective and willingness to upset even a pretty sturdy apple cart. So, don't spend all your time obsessing over what the competition is up to. Divert some of that energy to looking in the mirror to see how you appear to your employees, your competition, and your customers. And you shouldn't wait until the tires start falling off before you get out there and kick them. Do it while the going's good, if you want to keep it that way. Getting into the habit of looking at your business from the outside in will tell you a lot about how long those good results are likely to continue, or not.